The Taxicab Theory of Evolution. In An Appetite for Wonder, I recalled a visit to Oxford by a Japanese television crew. They turned up bristling with tripods, lights, umbrella reflectors and camera gear in a London taxi, and the director was keen to conduct the interview in the moving vehicle. This proved difficult, partly because the official interpreter's English was unintelligible to me, so interview perforce became impromptu monologue, while the unfortunate interpreter was banished to walk the streets for an hour, and partly because the bemused taxi driver from London didn't know Oxford, so I had to interrupt my discourse at frequent intervals to bark, "Turn left," or "Turn right," over my shoulder. When we returned to New College, I was curious to know why it had all had to be done in the taxi, so I asked the director and received the puzzled reply, "Oh, are you not author of Taxicab Theory of Evolution?" It was my turn to be puzzled until I later worked out the probable origin of his phrase. In my writings, I have made frequent reference to the body as the survival machine, or vehicle, for the genes that ride inside it. My guess, although I've never checked it, is that a Japanese translator of one of my writings must have rendered vehicle, with a little poetic license, as taxicab. Television being television, that would have been a sufficient reason for conducting the interview in a moving taxi. But never mind about taxicabs in particular, I need to explain the theoretical importance of the vehicle. One of the most persistent and annoying criticisms of the selfish gene is that it mistakes the level at which natural selection acts. Characteristically, the error was most articulately expressed by Stephen Gould, whose genius for getting things wrong matched the eloquence with which he did so. Challenges to Darwin's focus on individuals have sparked some lively debates among evolutionists. These challenges have come from above and from below. From above, Scottish biologist V.C. Wynne Edwards raised orthodox hackles 15 years ago by arguing that groups, not individuals, are units of selection, at least for the evolution of social behaviour. From below, English biologist Richard Dawkins has recently raised my hackles with his claim that genes themselves are units of selection, and individuals merely their temporary receptacles. Gould was right that Darwin focused on the individual organism as the unit of natural selection, and right about Wynne Edwards arguing for group selection as an alternative. Right, too, that I regard individuals as temporary receptacles for genes. But wrong, wrong, wrong to see that as a challenge to Darwin's focus on the individual. That whole above-below rhetoric is as misconceived as it is seductive. The gene, the individual, and the group are not rungs on the same ladder. If we must talk ladders, the gene is off to one side, more like a single rung all on its own. The gene and the individual are both units of natural selection, but in two different senses of unit, as replicator and as vehicle. Replicators, on this planet they are usually stretches of DNA code, occasionally RNA, are the units that actually survive, potentially for millions of years, or fail to survive. The world becomes full of successful replicators and empty of unsuccessful ones, where successful means literally good at surviving as copies through very many generations, even through geological deep time. What makes a replicator successful is its talent for influencing the world to promote its own survival. Exactly how it does so varies massively from species to species, but it typically involves influencing the development of vehicles to make them good at reproducing. And if it succeeds in surviving, it potentially survives again, and again, and again, into the indefinite future. So the difference between success and failure really matters for a replicator, that is. The same is not true of vehicles. No matter how successful or unsuccessful an organism may be, it will last only a single generation. Success for an organism means passing genes on to the distant future, before inevitably dying in the comparatively near future. Not even asexually reproducing animals like aphids or stick insects are replicators, as you can tell if you pull one leg off. There's no need to do anything so sadistic. You know what the result would be. That kind of mutation is not inherited. Remove or change a bit of DNA, however, and the change, a true mutation, may survive for a million generations. The word phenotype denotes the outward and physical levers used by replicators to promote their own survival, whether successfully or not. In practice, Phenotypes normally consist of features of individual organisms, and organisms are built by embryological processes influenced by the replicators that ride inside them. Organisms, especially animals, plants less so, are coherent, unified bodies that either survive as a whole or die as a whole. And when an animal dies, all its replicators die with it, except those that have previously been handed on to another organism in the process of reproduction. Do you begin to see how apt the word vehicle is, and throwaway survival machine? Most animals reproduce sexually, which means that the replicators inside them are continually changing partners, sharing new bodies with new combinations of replicators, serving yet again to emphasize the temporary nature of the individual survival machine, the mortal vehicle for immortal genes. This is not a way of thinking that would have occurred to most biologists a few decades ago. Genes would have been seen as tools used by organisms, rather than the other way around, as we now see things. Do you see, too, how persuasive, yet in very different ways, are the unitary qualities of both the gene, replicator, and the individual, vehicle? And do you see that both are units of natural selection, but in their two different senses? I tried and signally failed to explain this to Steve Gould when we had a much publicised debate in Oxford's Sheldonian Theatre in the late 1980s. The event was sponsored by Gould's publishers, W.W. Norton, and chaired by John Durant, then of Oxford's Department of Continuing Education. John hosted dinner for the three of us beforehand in the Randolph Hotel, where Steve was staying. I remember it as a rather frosty occasion, perhaps because Steve was not particularly friendly, perhaps because I was intimidated by the looming thought of Oxford's largest and most hallowed theatre, despite rehearsing and expert prepping with my closest friend at the time, Helena Cronin. My nervousness persisted into the debate itself, although I think I performed well enough, especially in the public conversation that followed our two prepared speeches. An audio tape of the two formal speeches was preserved and later broadcast by Robin Williams, star science journalist of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Unfortunately, no recording seems to have survived of the cut and thrust after the speeches, when most of the interesting points were made. The loss of this part of the tape is a matter of great regret to me, because I believe it would show, well, I would say that, wouldn't I, and Steve, alas, is no longer here to dissent, that I was right, and he simply couldn't get it. Two images add colour to this view of life, the Darwinian phrase borrowed by Steve Gould to head his column in Natural History, but here I'm re-borrowing it from Darwin for my own view of life. The first is from The Blind Watchmaker. A willow tree at the bottom of my garden pumping out downy seeds to cover the ground in all directions and down the Oxford Canal as far as my binoculars could reach. It is raining DNA outside. The whole performance, cotton wool, catkins, tree and all, is in aid of one thing and one thing only, the spreading of DNA around the countryside. Those fluffy specks are, literally, spreading instructions for making themselves. They are there because their ancestors succeeded in doing the same. It is raining instructions out there. It's raining programs. It's raining tree-growing, fluff-spreading algorithms. That's not a metaphor. It's the plain truth. It couldn't be any plainer if it were raining floppy disks. Floppy disks, that dates it. But the plain truth is timeless and deep, its truth undiminished by Moore's law, chipping away at the superficial imagery. Here, from January 2015, is a heartwarming illustration of what Twitter does well. There's a lot that it does badly. A woman quoted the above passage and added her own delightful reaction. It's winter outside, but spring inside. Suddenly, I'm lying on the grass under a willow tree. The second image is from Climbing Mount Improbable, 10 years later. I made a strong analogy between computer viruses and biological viruses. Both are programs that say, duplicate me and little else besides. What then of a large animal like an elephant? Elephant DNA instructions are also saying duplicate me, but they're saying it in a much more roundabout way. The DNA of an elephant constitutes a gigantic program, analogous to a computer program. Like the virus DNA, it is fundamentally a duplicate me program, but it contains an almost fantastically large digression as an essential part of the efficient execution of its fundamental message. That digression is an elephant. The program says, duplicate me by the roundabout route of building an elephant first. It is because an individual organism like an elephant is such a unitary and coherent entity, such a plausible and persuasive vehicle, that the great majority of evolutionary biologists have followed Darwin in treating the organism as the main agent of biological adaptation. Ethologists follow Darwin in seeing animal behavior as a striving by individual animals to survive and reproduce. This is correct, but you have to take a sophisticated view of the quantity that this agent is striving to maximize. Population geneticists call it fitness, which is, or is proportional to, a kind of weighted sum of children, grandchildren, and other descendants. Parental care and self-sacrifice in the interests of offspring are obviously easily accommodated in this formulation, as is Darwin's other theory of sexual selection. But R.A. Fisher, J.B.S. Haldane, and above all W.D. Hamilton, realized that natural selection could also favor individuals who care for collateral kin, who have a statistical probability of sharing the genes that mediate the caring. One way to approach the argument is a thought experiment, which, in The Selfish Gene, I dubbed the green beard. Most new mutations have more than one effect on bodies. The phenomenon is called pleiotropy. Imagine a gene which gives individuals a conspicuous label, like a green beard, and simultaneously confers benign feelings towards green beards and a tendency to help green-bearded individuals to survive and reproduce. The contingency is a remote one, sir, as Jeeves would say, but it makes the point. Such a gene would spread through the population. The idea caught on. A Google search for green beard effect achieves lots of hits and even some photos, but my purpose was only to pave the way for an explanation of kin selection. Pleiotropic coincidences of bodily peculiarities coupled with altruistic tendencies towards those peculiarities are improbable, although several suggestive examples have since appeared in the scientific literature. What is not at all improbable, however, is a statistical equivalent of the green beard effect, a statistical watering down of it. If you know who your brother is, you don't have to specify a particular gene like a green beard gene. You can calculate the probability that he will share any particular gene with you. It's actually a bit more complicated than that. Genes that are common in the population are perforce shared by most of us anyway, and indeed by most individuals of some other species. The particular sense of probability of sharing that is relevant to the theory of kin selection is something more like probability over and above the baseline set by the population as a whole. The best way to visualize this subtle idea is with a geometric model developed by Alan Graffen. Such a shared gene could plausibly be a hypothetical gene for being nice to brothers, or, more practically, a hypothetical gene for being nice to individuals with whom you shared a childhood nest, or individuals who smell like you, a practical rule of thumb for identifying siblings. Such a gene could easily be favored in practice for the same reason as a green beard gene would be favored in theory. Kinship, or in practice nest-sharing or smelling like me, is a realistic statistical proxy for the unrealistic green beard. Hamilton, in 1964, published a mathematical way to redefine fitness to take account of kinship from the individual organism's point of view. He came up with the concept of inclusive fitness. I informally, perhaps too informally, but Hamilton himself gave his blessing, redefined inclusive fitness as that quantity which an individual will appear to be maximizing when what is really being maximized is gene survival. The following table summarizes the two ideas of replicator and vehicle and explains how both are units of selection, but in different senses. Unit of selection, gene, role, replicator, quantity maximized, survival. Unit of selection, individual organism, role, vehicle, quantity maximized, inclusive fitness. In The Extended Phenotype, I used the analogy of the Necker cube to argue that both these ways of looking at natural selection amount to the same thing, just as both views of the Necker cube are equally compatible with the information flowing in from the eyes. I shall return to the Necker cube in a later section of this chapter. In The Selfish Gene, I claimed to follow Hamilton, but Hamilton himself switched between two ways of expressing himself, the gene-centered way and the individual-centered inclusive fitness way. Here's how he put the gene-centered view. A gene is being favoured in natural selection if the aggregate of its replicas form an increasing fraction of the total gene pool. We are going to be concerned with genes supposed to affect the social behaviour of their bearers, so let us try to make the argument more vivid by attributing to the genes temporally intelligence and a certain freedom of choice. Imagine that a gene is considering the problem of increasing the numbers of its replicas. He wrote those words some 8 years after his Inclusive Fitness paper, but it's entirely clear that the same gene-centred view undergirded the epic 1964 Tour de Force as well. In The Selfish Gene, I too switched pretty freely between the gene itself as metaphorical agent or decision-maker and a kind of informal inclusive fitness approach in which I allowed individual organisms to soliloquise about what would be best for their genes. Neither of these kinds of subjective soliloquy, needless to say, is intended to be taken literally. The agents, in both cases, should be thought of as behaving as if calculating optimal courses of action, but only as if. Although Hamilton based his idea on the gene's eye view, inclusive fitness is nevertheless a way of preserving the traditional focus on the individual organism, the vehicle. Indeed, I see it as a regrettably cumbersome bending over backwards to rescue the individual as the focus of our Darwinian attention instead of the gene. But why is the organism such a salient and discrete vehicle at all? Why do we take the organism for granted? Just as we ask why wings and eyes, antlers and penises exist and expect to get a gene-centred answer, shouldn't the gene's eye view lead us to ask why organisms themselves exist? Genes survive by pulling phenotypic levers of power. But why are those phenotypic levers bundled into discrete vehicles, which we call organisms, and why do the immortal replicators choose to gang up with other genes to share vehicles? This was the point at which I went beyond Hamilton, while never really going against anything he said. I did so in my second book, The Extended Phenotype. After interviewing me for his own book, A Reason for Everything, subtitled Natural Selection and the English Imagination, Marek Cohn put the point well. Having based his first book on the assumption that if adaptations are to be treated as for the good of something, that something is the gene, Dawkins was now mounting an attempt to free the selfish gene from the individual organism which has been its conceptual prison. One of the jailers of this Bastille was Bill Hamilton, who found himself cast in the role of the revolutionary deemed insufficiently radical by his disciple. Although Dawkins never wavered in his admiration for Hamilton, he felt that the idea of inclusive fitness was an obstacle to seeing biological facts through the gene's eye. Inclusive fitness was about the selection of genes, but it complicated the issue by trying to fit into biology's existing frame of reference. Before Hamilton's revolution, our world was peopled by individual organisms working single-mindedly to keep themselves alive and to have children. In those days, it was natural to measure success in this undertaking at the level of the individual organism. Hamilton changed all that, but unfortunately, instead of following his ideas through to their logical conclusion and sweeping the organism from its pedestal, he exerted his genius in devising a means of rescuing the individual. John Maynard Smith, in my Web of Stories interview with him in 1997, said very much the same thing. Extending the phenotype. If St. Peter were to twist my arm at the pearly gates and force me to come up with an answer to the question of how, if at all, I might justify having occupied a little space on this earth and exchanged a fraction of its air, the best I could do would be to point to the extended phenotype. It isn't really a new hypothesis which might be right or might be wrong to be tested by experiment or observation. It's more like a new way of looking at what is already familiar, a way of looking at biology that helps things fall into place and make sense. I suppose it's a bit like, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Trite, necessarily true, definitely not the sort of statement for which you would go out and seek supporting evidence, but nevertheless, we recognise it as a truth that changes the way we see things. Obvious as it is, it can be worth bothering to say to somebody as a way of influencing the way they do things. That's how I see the extended phenotype. But instead of being summarised in a pithy aphorism, it needs explaining. One way to say it is that it amounts to a questioning of the assumed centrality of the vehicle. The phenotypic influence of a gene had been thought to end at the body wall of the individual containing that gene. Genes influence bodies via the processes of embryonic development. A mutant version of a gene subtly changes some detail of the shape of a swift's wing. As a consequence, the bird flies slightly faster for the same expenditure of energy, and this makes it slightly more likely to survive and therefore pass on the very same gene to future generations. Multiply the effect over many swifts and over many generations, and the result will be that the mutant gene comes to dominate the population at the expense of alternative alleles. That is, alternative versions of the gene sitting at the same locus on the chromosomes of the population. All genes exert their immediate effects in ways that are buried deep in the internal biochemistry of the individual body, and these are usually invisible to all but specialist scientists. But the phenotypic effect, which we finally recognise as the adaptation or survival tool, is usually external and visible to the naked eye, as in the case of the swift's wing. There is a cascade of internally buried causes and effects, often beginning with the synthesis of a protein precisely coded by the DNA sequence. We could arbitrarily identify a phenotype at any point along the cascade, the protein itself, its immediate effect as a catalyst of cellular biochemistry, the consequent effect on the behaviour of cells interacting in tissues, many more downstream consequences, before we finally hit something visible on the outside of the animal, a webby foot on a duck, perhaps, or a larger wing on a wasp, or a more stilted courtship gesture in an albatross. All these are properly called phenotypic effects of a gene. What I added in the extended phenotype was the thought that the sequence of causes and effects doesn't have to stop at the body wall. Take, for instance, the set of tubes built by Jane Brockman's mud-daubing wasps, Tripoxylon palitum. Each tube is like an organ of the body, an external uterus for the nurturing of young. It has been shaped to a useful purpose by natural selection, in just the same kind of way as the wasp's wings or legs or antennae. The genes exerted their influence via building behaviour, before that via a carefully rigged nervous system, before that by cell growth programmes in embryology, before that by biochemical influences on cell growth, before that by protein synthesis under the influence of genes in the nuclei of cells. As with legs and wings, genes that influence for the better the shape and size of the mud organ have been favoured by natural selection. And as with legs and wings, genes, in interaction with lots of other genes, influence the shape and size of the mud organ by indirect processes, beginning with an effect on cellular chemistry and running through a cascade of intermediate causes to the final phenotype. Yes, that's right, phenotype. That's the point I'm making. This phenotype is made of mud rather than living cells, hence extended phenotype, but it is no less a true phenotype. The mud in the stream before the wasp fetches it is not phenotype. It becomes phenotype when it is shaped to a biological purpose, in this case the purpose of protecting a growing larva. It is phenotype because the shape and other properties of the tube have evolved over many generations of increasing perfection. So there must be genes for tube length, genes for tube diameter, genes for thickness of tube wall, genes for distance between partitions down the length of the tube. How do I know those genes exist? I don't, not in the sense that anyone has ever done a genetic study of the phenotypic traits I've just listed. But I'm confident that, if such a genetic study were undertaken, and it certainly could be, all those phenotypic traits would be found to vary under genetic control. Why so confident? Because the tubes constructed by the mud dauber have obviously been shaped to their well-designed form by natural selection, and the logic of natural selection implies the involvement of genes. How else than by favouring certain genes over other genes could natural selection have shaped mud tubes towards increasing suitability to their function of protecting larvae? Of course, to repeat, the genes affect the tubes only indirectly via the building behaviour of wasps, and before that, in the causal chain via wasp nervous systems, and before that, via cellular processes making wasp nervous systems. But all phenotypic effects are indirect anyway. The influence of genes on mud tubes is indirect in exactly the same kind of way as the influence of genes on wings, legs, and antennae. And the extended phenotype we're looking at may not be the last point on the cascade of causes and effects. Anything caused by it downstream in the cascade could be seen as a further extended phenotype, provided only that genes responsible for it have been favoured as a result by natural selection. The picture reproduced in the E appendix shows variation in tube colour. Are there then genes for tube colour? Maybe. Here I'm less confident, but only because it is not obvious that tube colour has been favoured by natural selection. It is possible that some colours are better than others, and possible that genes make wasps fussy about the colour of mud they gather. On the other hand, it could well be that the wasps are indifferent to colour of mud, simply gathering it from whatever is available in a local stream, which might happen to be light brown, dark brown, or reddish brown. Why doesn't the same indifference argument apply to length of tube or thickness of wall? It might, but it seems unlikely in those cases. It is easy to see that the tube wall could be too thin for purpose, offering inadequate protection for the larva, or even falling apart. And it could be too thick, using too much mud, requiring more time-consuming trips to the stream. It is hard to see how thickness of tube wall could not be subject to natural selection. I personally suspect that tube colour is also subject to natural selection. Some colours might be easier for predators to see, but it is entirely plausible that the time-saving advantages of fetching mud from the nearest stream, regardless of colour, rather than searching far and wide for a stream with better coloured mud, could be paramount. These are hypothetical details for illustration only. The point is that the logic of natural selection, its choice of genes by virtue of their phenotypic effects, compels us to recognise that such functional phenotypes are not limited to the individual body, the vehicle. Animal artefacts provide the clearest and simplest example, and here I benefited from my close friendship as a graduate student at Oxford, where we shared a flat, with Michael Hansel. Mike is now the world's leading authority on animal artefacts and author of several books on the subject, including the beautiful Built by Animals, which cleverly uses the subject of artefacts as a platform to talk about many aspects of animal behaviour more generally. The extended phenotype has a whole chapter on animal artefacts, from caddis larva houses to bird nests to termite mounds to beaver dams. Even the lake created by a beaver dam is properly regarded as extended phenotypic expression of beaver genes, probably the largest phenotype in the world. If the extended phenotype had restricted its scope to artefacts such as Jane Brockman's mud dauber tubes or Mike Hansel's caddis mobile homes, I wouldn't have bothered to say, and the publishers wouldn't have bothered to print on the paperback cover, "If you never read anything else of mine, please at least read this." But the extension goes further. The chapter on animal artefacts softens the reader up for the more radical ideas of parasite manipulation of hosts and action at a distance. A fluke lives inside its snail shell, as a caddis larva lives inside its stone house. The fluke doesn't build its shell as the caddis builds its house, but if the fluke could find a way to modify the snail shell to its own advantage, and if we can be sure the modification was favoured by natural selection, Neo-Darwinian logic forces us to recognise a fluke gene for snail shell characteristics. The logic of the extended phenotype, if you buy the analogy with the caddis house, and how could you not, concludes that fluke genomes contain genes for snail phenotypes, at least in the same way as they contain genes for fluke phenotypes. The shell of a snail is its protective dwelling, just as the stone house is that of the caddis. We would not be surprised to find that parasitic infection debilitates a snail, for example, causing the shell to be thinner than it should be, and the snail more vulnerable. But what shall we say if a snail shell is thicker when it has a parasite? Such is indeed the case for snails parasitised by some flukes. Is the snail better protected as a result of some parasitic influence? Is the fluke doing the snail an altruistic good turn? Is the snail actually better off for housing a parasite? In one sense, probably yes, but not a good Darwinian sense. Here's what I think. Everything about an animal is a compromise between conflicting pressures. Just as a shell can be too thin for the snail's own good, so it can also be too thick. How so? It's a question of economics, as so often in evolutionary theory. The wherewithal to make a shell, calcium for example, is expensive. As we saw in the chapter on digger wasp economics, too much investment in one part of the body's economy has to be paid for in the form of too little investment in some other part. A snail that invests too heavily in its shell must skimp on something else and will be less successful than a rival snail that invests a bit less in the shell and therefore more somewhere else. We may presume that the average shell thickness of unparasitized snails is an optimum. When a fluke forces its snail to thicken its shell, it is pushing that snail away from the snail optimum and in the direction of a different and more costly optimum, which is the fluke optimum. Is it plausible that the fluke optimum should be thicker than the snail optimum? Yes, actually very plausible. Any animal has to balance the needs of individual survival against those of reproduction. Peacocks and peahens sit at different optima along the sex survival continuum. Hens care more about survival, cocks more about reproduction, even at the cost of a shorter life. This is because, not having to lay large, costly eggs, a cock can potentially pack far more reproduction into a short life than a hen can. Most cocks are less successful in terms of passing on genes than the average hen, but a few elite cocks are far more successful than the average hen, and are so even if they die young. Cocks tend to inherit their characteristics from ancestors belonging to the elite minority who died young after a bonanza of reproduction. Therefore, a tendency to shift the bodily economy away from the individual survival optimum and towards the reproduction optimum is favoured in cocks. The snail cares about its reproduction, the end towards which its survival is just the means. The fluke doesn't care at all about the reproductive success of the particular snail which is its present domicile. As between snail survival and snail reproduction, the fluke genes reach a different compromise from the snail genes. The snail genes want to save some resources for snail reproduction and so compromise on survival. The fluke genes want the snail to put all its resources into preserving the protective house in which the fluke rides, snail survival, and to hell with snail reproduction. Things would be different if flukes were passed directly from parent snail to offspring snail. In that case, the flukes too would care about snail reproduction, not just snail survival. This is one of the most important lessons from the extended phenotype. Parasites become gentler to their hosts, more symbiotic, to the extent that their offspring infect the offspring of their particular hosts rather than getting passed on to random members of the host species. Parasite genes, then, can have extended effects on host phenotypes. The parasitology literature is filled with fascinating, even macabre, accounts of hosts whose habits are manipulated to facilitate the life cycles of the parasites that ride inside them. And my chapter, Host Phenotypes of Parasite Genes, lists lots of examples. It's almost as though the parasite is pulling the host's puppet strings, and the logic of natural selection compels us to carry that image down to the level of the parasite's genes. In 2012, David Hughes and his colleagues published a splendid book on host manipulation by parasites, which takes a very extended phenotype view of the facts. Action at a distance. But parasites don't necessarily ride in or on their hosts. Empty space supervenes between cuckoo and host, but the cuckoo is no less a parasite, and the distorted parental behaviour of the foster parent is no less a naturally selected adaptation of the cuckoo nestling. By what black arts of seduction does the monstrous cuckoo nestling cajole the nervous system of the tiny wren? We don't know, but it is surely the product of an evolutionary arms race. In that arms race, natural selection of cuckoos implies selection of cuckoo genes for manipulating hosts. And that's just another way of saying there are cuckoo genes for host behaviour, cuckoo genes whose phenotypic effects are manifested as complacent changes in host behaviour. So the extended phenotype extends beyond the body wall, beyond the stone house enclosing the caddis, beyond the snail shell enclosing the fluke, right outside the body and across the space between cuckoo and host, a space in which something is transmitted from the one and picked up by the other. This is the meaning of action at a distance, which is the title of the penultimate chapter of the extended phenotype. And it doesn't apply only to parasites and hosts. If a physiologist wants to bring a female canary into reproductive condition, increase the size of her functional ovary, and cause her to start nest building and other reproductive behaviour patterns, there are various things he can do. He can inject her with gonadotropins or estrogens. He can use electric light to increase the day length that she experiences. Or, most interestingly from our point of view, he can play her a tape recording of male canary song. It apparently has to be canary song. Budgerigar song will not do, although budgerigar song has a similar effect on female budgerigars. That quotation is from an earlier chapter of The Extended Phenotype, the one on arms races and manipulation, but it serves equally to illustrate action at a distance. Genes in male canaries have been naturally selected for their extended phenotypic effect at a distance on female canaries. This theme was foreshadowed in a 1978 paper which I wrote jointly with my friend John Krebs, called Animal Signals, Information or Manipulation. That paper could be credited with importing the selfish gene revolution into the study of animal signals such as birdsong. Hitherto, under the influence of Nico Tinbergen, Mike Cullen, Desmond Morris, and other ethologists of the Tinbergen-Lawrence School, animal signals had been treated in a cooperative spirit. Both parties to the communication would benefit from a flow of accurate information between them. I'm informing you, for our mutual benefit, that I'm a male of your species, possessing a territory, and I'm ready to mate. John Krebs and I turned that on its head by regarding the sender of the signal as manipulating the receiver, as if flooding her nervous system with a drug, or as if stimulating her brain electrically with microelectrodes. I put the point with calculated bathos in The Extended Phenotype. The snort of a pig frog, Rana Grillo, may affect another pig frog as the nightingale affected Keats or the skylark Shelley. And much later in Unweaving the Rainbow, whose title was paraphrased from Keats, I said something like it again after quoting the Ode to a Nightingale. Keats may not have intended it literally, but the idea of nightingale song working as a drug is not totally far-fetched. Consider what it is doing in nature and what natural selection has shaped it to do. Male nightingales need to influence the behaviour of female nightingales and of other males. Some ornithologists have thought of song as conveying information. I am a male of the species Lucinia megarynchos in breeding condition, with a territory hormonally primed to mate and build a nest. Yes, the song does contain that information, in the sense that a female who acted on the assumption that it was true could benefit thereby. But another way to look at it has always seemed to me more vivid. The song is not informing the female, but manipulating her. It is not so much changing what the female knows as directly changing the internal physiological state of her brain. It is acting like a drug. There is experimental evidence from measuring the hormone levels of female doves and canaries, as well as their behaviour, that the sexual state of females is directly influenced by the vocalisations of males, the effects being integrated over a period of days. The sounds from a male canary flood through the female's ears into her brain, where they have an effect that is indistinguishable from one that an experimenter can procure with a hypodermic syringe. The male's drug enters the female through the portals of her ears, rather than through a hypodermic, but this difference does not seem particularly telling. In my more grandiose moments, I dreamed of encompassing the whole field of animal communication in extended phenotypic action at a distance. In theory, genetic action at a distance could include almost all interactions between individuals of the same or different species. The living world can be seen as a network of interlocking fields of replicator power. Unfortunately, it is still hard for me to imagine the kind of mathematics that the understanding of the details will eventually demand. I have a dim vision of phenotypic characters in an evolutionary space being tugged in different directions by replicators under selection. And it is still true that I have not the wings to fly in mathematical spaces. There must be a verbal message. Most serious field biologists now subscribe to the theorem, largely due to Hamilton, that animals are expected to behave as if maximising the survival chances of all the genes inside them. I have amended this to a new central theorem of the extended phenotype. An animal's behaviour tends to maximise the survival of the genes for that behaviour, whether or not those genes happen to be in the body of the particular animal performing the behaviour. The two theorems would amount to the same thing if animal phenotypes were always under the unadulterated control of their own genotypes and uninfluenced by the genes of other organisms. Rediscovering the organism, passengers and stowaways. What then of the organism as vehicle? There may be planets out there with life forms whose replicators, I conjecture that there must be replicators at the root, wherever life might be found, have no bounded vehicles, planets where the whole biosphere is a crisscrossing web of extended phenotypic influences radiating out from unbounded replicators. But on our planet, it isn't like that. Organisms, discrete units shared by lots of cooperating replicators, dominate. Almost all replicators, instead of being free, ride together inside massive vehicles, swarm inside great lumbering robots sealed off from the outside world, as I put it in a controversially much-quoted passage of The Selfish Gene. Why do our genes swarm together and work together to one end? Whence the organism? In The Extended Phenotype, I conjured a thought experiment with two hypothetical seaweeds renamed in the second edition of The Selfish Gene as splurge weed, which simply grows at its margins and then fragments vegetatively, and bottle rack, whose genes, unlike those of splurge weed, are funneled down to a single-cell propagule, a genetic bottleneck in every generation. Rather than repeating the argument here, I'll go straight to the more practical conclusion, which, in a sense, flows naturally from the very idea of the extended phenotype. The genes in a discretely vehicular organism work together to a common end because they all share the same bottleneck, exit route to the future, the sperms or eggs of the organism that they share. If some genes have a different exit route, for example, getting sneezed out of the present organism instead of ejaculated, they don't cooperate and we use a name like virus. The coherent unity of the organism depends on the fact that its genes share an exit route and hence share their expectations, even hopes, of the future. Fluke genes and snail genes favour different optima for snail shell thickness. Snail genes are more interested in snail reproduction and fluke genes more interested in snail survival. Fluke genes would agree with snail genes only if their reproductive propagules made the journey to the next generation in the sperms or eggs of their shared snail. If a bacterium had no other way to reach the future than to enter its host's eggs, and hence the bodies of only its host's offspring, its genes and the host's genes would be subject to near identical selection pressures. Both would want not only that the host should survive, but also that she should build a nest, attract a mate, ward off egg stealers, feed the young, even care for grandchildren. Such a parasite would cease to deserve the name. Its genes would evolve to become so intimately wedded to those of the host that its identity would merge into that of the host, with only a Cheshire Cat grin left behind to betray its parasitic origin. Mitochondria, those vital little energy-releasing bodies that swarm inside all our cells, started out as bacterial stowaways, but they became proper passengers because they came to share an exit route, the vehicle's eggs, with all the other genes of the cooperative. So subtle was the Cheshire grin of the mitochondria, the image is borrowed from my sometime Oxford colleague Professor David Smith, that we've only just noticed that they originated as bacteria. The reason they cooperate with us rather than fight us is that they share not only the big vehicles that we call bodies, many virulent parasites do that, but also, crucially, the mini-vehicles, eggs, which, in this hypothetical case, transport them from body to body. The surreal-sounding conclusion, which follows from the logic of the extended phenotype, is that all our genes, all our own genes, all our own genes, can be thought of as a gigantic colony of viruses. Amicable viruses, distinguished from the malevolent ones only by the fact that their expected route to the future is to be not sneezed out, not coughed or breathed or excreted out, but pumped out through the legitimate conduit of sperms or eggs directly into the offspring of the present host. Our own genes, amicable viruses, can be thought of as paid-up passengers in the vehicle, as opposed to stowaways like the chickenpox virus or the various flu viruses. At its deepest level, the difference between the two lies in their exit route from the vehicle. This is perhaps the main message of the extended phenotype, and it would be my Exhibit A at the Pearly Court of St. Peter. It's nearly obvious when you think it through, but I don't think anybody else ever put it in this way. Aftermaths to the extended phenotype. Three aftermaths to the extended phenotype have given me particular pleasure. The first, in 1999, was the marvellously insightful afterword to a new paperback printing written by the distinguished philosopher of science and first Simony lecturer, also in 1999, Daniel Dennett. The second was a special issue of the journal Biology and Philosophy devoted to a critically retrospective look at the first 20 years of the extended phenotype. And the third was a conference near Copenhagen organised by David Hughes, convened to review the successes and failures of the idea of the extended phenotype. Dan Dennett's afterword to the 1999 reprinting gave me especial joy because here was a philosopher arguing the case for the extended phenotype as a work of philosophy. I confess to a certain exasperation when I read people bending over backwards to be complimentary about my science as a prelude to saying that I should stick to science and not stray into the territory of philosophy. But what is the territory of philosophy, other than clear and logical thinking? Don't scientists have to think clearly and logically too? It is, of course, true that a professional biologist is typically not as well read in the philosophers of the past as he would be if his degree were in philosophy. This might make him neglect an apposite citation of Hume, Locke, or Wittgenstein. But that doesn't of itself mean he can't present a clear and logical argument of a philosophical character. I hope I won't sound too defensive, therefore, if I quote Dennett on the subject. Why is a philosopher writing an afterword for this book? Is the extended phenotype science or philosophy? It is both. It is science, certainly, but it is also what philosophy should be, and only intermittently is, a scrupulously reasoned argument that opens our eyes to a new perspective, clarifying what had been murky and ill-understood, and giving us a new way of thinking about topics we thought we already understood. As Richard Dawkins says at the outset, the extended phenotype may not constitute a testable hypothesis in itself, but it so far changes the way we see animals and plants that it may cause us to think of testable hypotheses that we would otherwise never have dreamed of. And what is this new way of thinking? It is not just the gene's eye point of view made famous in Dawkins' 1976 book, The Selfish Gene. Building here on that foundation, he shows how our traditional way of thinking about organisms should be replaced by a richer version in which the boundary between organism and environment first dissolves and then gets partially rebuilt on a deeper foundation. For the professional philosopher, I cannot resist adding, there is a feast, some of the most masterful, sustained chains of reasoning I've ever encountered. Forgive the self-indulgence in my quoting that last sentence. I am, perhaps oversensitively, trying to redress the balance after being described as philosophically naive. Dennett develops his theme, illustrating it with page citations from the book. His examples include some of my thought experiments, and this is especially interesting as he himself is a preeminent master of the thought experiment as an intuition pump. Continuing the theme of the extended phenotype as a work of philosophy, in 2002 the Australian philosopher Kim Sterelny, editor of Biology and Philosophy, decided to mark the 20th anniversary of the book with a special issue of that interdisciplinary journal. In the event, owing to various delays, the commemorative issue didn't finally come out until 2004, but that didn't matter. Sterelny commissioned three scholars, Kevin Leyland, J. Scott Turner, and Eva Jablonka, each to write a retrospective evaluation and critique of the book, to be followed by a detailed response from me. We all four accepted the invitation, and I must say I enjoyed reading the papers and writing my response more than I expected to. The title of my reply was Extended Phenotype, but Not Too Extended. Not too extended is a phrase I had used before in response to audience questions about human artifacts. If a weaver bird's nest is an extended phenotype, would you say the same of the Sydney Opera House or the Chrysler Building? No, I wouldn't, and the answer is more interesting than the question. A bird's nest or a caddis house or a mud dauber set of pipes is a product of natural selection. Natural selection chose genes that fostered good building behaviour. Ancestral weaver birds varied in their building styles and skills. Some of that variation was genetic and was favoured or disfavoured by virtue of the success or failure of the resulting nests in protecting eggs and nestlings containing the genes concerned. In order for man-made buildings to qualify as extended phenotypes, it would be necessary for variation among buildings to be caused by variation in architects' genes. We can't absolutely rule that out, but to put it mildly, it doesn't strike me as a promising line of research. It wouldn't surprise me to find genetic variance in architectural talent. If one identical twin were good at three-dimensional visualization, I would expect that his twin would be too. But I'd be very surprised to find genes for Gothic arches, postmodern finials, or neoclassical architraves, whereas I would expect to find their equivalents in caddis larvae, mud-daubing wasps, or dam-building beavers. The extension to human architects was not the only too extended that I had in mind in the title of my biology and philosophy paper. My main problem there was with a voguish and rather tiresome notion called niche construction. A big example shows how this loose and vague idea confuses people. The free oxygen in our atmosphere is entirely put there by plants, including photosynthetic bacteria. Early in life's history, there was no free oxygen. The green bacteria, and later plants, who put it there, massively changed the niches of all subsequent life forms, including themselves. Most creatures today would die instantly without oxygen. That was niche-changing, an incidental, not constructed, byproduct of photosynthetic activity. Photosynthesis was naturally selected because of its immediate nutritional benefits for the green bacteria themselves. It was not naturally selected because of its effects on the atmosphere. Those green bacteria made oxygen not because they or their descendants or anyone else would benefit from breathing oxygen in the future. They made oxygen as a byproduct because they couldn't help it when photosynthesizing. After the oxygen was made, subsequent natural selection favored those bacteria and other creatures capable of flourishing in oxygen. The niche was inadvertently changed, and everybody subsequently evolved to cope with what was at first a pollutant. Natural selection implies a discriminating genetic advantage to the organism concerned, as opposed to general advantage to the world at large. When positive advantage accrues, meaning genetic advantage specifically for the individual doing it, as opposed to the world at large, we have an extended phenotype. Otherwise, we have no extended phenotype and no niche construction, merely niche changing. A true extended phenotype, such as a bird's nest or a beaver dam, or the subverted parental behaviour of a cuckoo's foster parent, has to be a Darwinian adaptation for the benefit of the genes that mediate it. Niche construction is a phrase that can be meaningful if used with care. Since it is so often used without care and without full Darwinian understanding, it is a phrase that I would prefer to see not used. When it is used properly and with care, it becomes a special case of an extended phenotype, the special case where an animal changes its niche for the benefit of its own genes. A beaver dam is an example. There may not be many others. The same confusion between the extended phenotype and niche construction improperly used as a synonym for niche changing was somewhat in evidence at the third of my aftermaths, a conference on extended phenotypes convened in 2008 in a large country house near Copenhagen. The organiser was David Hughes, a talented young Irish biologist now working in America, and he attracted a splendid cast list of distinguished scientists, including both critics and supporters of the extended phenotype. There's a good report on the conference in the journal Science Daily with the title European Evolutionary Biologists Rally Behind Richard Dawkins's Extended Phenotype. The description European, by the way, was belied by the presence of American scientists, including the distinguished geneticist Mark Feldman, one of the critics. David Hughes is now the world's leading exponent in practice of the theoretical idea of the extended phenotype. He would be the ideal first director of the hypothetical Extended Phenotypics Institute of the future, the fantasy pipe dream I described as the climax to my biology and philosophy paper. After the formal unveiling by Nobel Prize-winning scientists, royalty wasn't considered good enough, the guests are shown wonderingly around the new building. There are three wings: the Zoological Artifact Museum, ZAM, the Laboratory of Parasite Extended Genetics, PEG, and the Centre for Action at a Distance, CAD. In all three wings, familiar phenomena are studied from an unfamiliar perspective, different angles on a Necker cube. The scientists in all three wings pride themselves on the disciplined rigour of their theory. The motto carved over the main door of their institute is a one locus mutation of St. Paul. But the greatest of these is clarity. It would now be necessary to add a medical wing to my fantasy institute. The American biologist Paul Ewald is one of today's leaders, along with Randolph Nesse and David Haig, of the burgeoning field of Darwinian medicine. I'm grateful to that inspired pioneer Robert Trivers for calling my attention to a fascinating paper by Paul and Holly Ewald on a Darwinian approach to cancer, which makes use of the idea of the extended phenotype. It is well understood that the cells within a tumour are subject to natural selection within the tumour. But it's time-limited rather than open-ended natural selection. Mutant cells that become better at being cancerous, emphatically not better for the patient, outcompete less malignant cells within the tumour, becoming more numerous in the tumour. But that evolutionary process terminates with the death of the patient, and there exists a parallel, but more long-term, because transgenerational, selection of genes in the rest of the body to resist cancers, erect barriers against them, develop immunological tricks against them, and so on. It's an asymmetric arms race because the anti-cancer tricks have been honed against cancers of many past generations. The tricks of the tumours themselves have to be evolved afresh in each generation, for they begin their malign evolution anew in each body, starting as normal healthy cells, which then are naturally selected to evolve, step by step, the qualities needed to outcompete other cancer cells in the race to multiply. The idea of an arms race between bodies and their cancers prompts interesting thoughts. Cancers are parasites, and particularly insidious ones, because their cells are almost, but importantly not quite, identical to their hosts. This makes them harder for the body, and for medical therapies, to discriminate against than foreign parasites like tapeworms or bacteria. Over many generations and many tussles against successive cancers, skills for recognising suspected cancer cells are honed. As in any such arms race, a balance must be struck between being too risk-averse, seeing danger where none exists, and too laid-back, failing to see danger where it really exists. This is analogous to the dilemma of a grazing antelope who sees a rustle in the long grass and has to decide whether it is a predator or just the wind. The jumpy antelope, who reacts fearfully to every rustle, ends each day undernourished because it keeps interrupting its grazing to flee. The laid-back antelope, who carries on grazing where others would flee, is at risk of ending up in a leopard's stomach. Natural selection of antelope genes settles on a judicious balance between the risk-averse Scylla and the laid-back Charybdis. The immune system walks the same tightrope in detecting malignant cells. Too laid-back, and the patient dies of cancer. Too jumpy, too risk-averse, and the immune system attacks harmless, normal cells, wrongly suspecting them of being cancerous. Well, can you think of a better explanation for autoimmune diseases like alopecia, psoriasis, or eczema? Allergies, too, of course, can be understood as risk-averse, trigger-happy overreactions of the immune system. The original twist added by the Ewalds to this analysis is the importation of the idea of the extended phenotype. The tumour lives and evolves in a micro-environment provided by the surrounding cells of the body. The improved malignant tricks that tumour cells evolve in their within-body natural selection largely consists of manipulations of the micro-environment. For example, tumour cells, no less than other cells, indeed probably more, need a good blood supply to feed and oxygenate them. Just as a beaver's genes work on beaver behaviour to construct the extended phenotype which dams a stream to make a lake, so the mutated and evolving genes in a tumour construct an extended phenotype which is an improved blood supply to the tumour. The cells of the enlarged or diverted blood vessels are not cancerous. They are manipulated by the cancer cells, and since this is a true Darwinian adaptation, for the benefit of the cancer, not the body, the changes in the blood supply constitute a true extended phenotype of mutated genes in the tumour. The Ewalds make full use of extended phenotype terminology in their paper, and I'm delighted that they regard the idea as helpful.